Greetings again, my lovely ding-dongs. It is I, Allison Dixon, back to bring you on another voyage across our lovely planet in part two of our 10 Countries, 10 Mystery series with my buddy Chris Armstrong from the 80s High Podcast. Welcome back, Chris.
I'm so glad to be back for this next batch Oh mysteries.
I don't even like to waste time, you know, with the before show stuff because I like to dig in and find out where we're going and what we're doing when we get there.
Absolutely.
We have a packed itinerary, just as we did last week. Last week's episode was just mostly focused in Scandinavian countries. Mm-hmm. And this week, we're going a little bit everywhere, kind of to multiple corners, sort of, kind of, little bit.
A little more varied this go around, for sure, for sure.
I start off this episode this time, and it is in a country that I honestly have always wanted to go to, but mostly because it just looks like such a tranquil, quaint, beautiful little place that I can't imagine anything bad happening there. And I'm talking about the Netherlands.
Yeah.
We're going full Dutch. You know, when I think of the Netherlands, I think of windmills and wheat fields and just this beautiful countryside. And when I was doing my research, I couldn't find Jack. I was like, does anything happen in the Netherlands? So, anything bad? Because, you know, I think it's just, you know, as someone who's never been there and I've only seen it through pictures, I sometimes think to myself, you know, what we assume about a country is often the more simplistic version. So,
sure.
So I sent a message to my buddy Brett from the prosecutors. We were chit-chatting and I'm like, do you know of anything bad that's ever happened in the Netherlands? Because I cannot find anything. I'm doing the research for this. And he immediately came back to me with something that proved to bear some fruit. And I am excited. I am excited. Off the top of your head, Chris, and I know you hate these. I know you hate it when I do this to you, but I'm gonna, I have faith.
Okay.
Probably other than Leonardo da Vinci, can you think of as the most famous painter of all time?
Picasso?
We got to go back a little further, but you're not too far off. Little more eccentric. Little more.
I want to say Salvador Dali, but I don't think that's the direction you're going. But
had a reputation for being a little mentally quirky, let's just say. But his paintings are indelible. They are unique. There's nothing like them, and they are everywhere. And I am just going to say Starry Night.
Yes.
Sunflowers.
Munch. Edvard Munch?
Van Gogh.
Oh, Van... Jeez Louise. Van Gogh. My goodness.
I literally gave you every clue.
I was thinking of the Scream. You know, I was starting to think of Van Gogh, and then I was so, under the gun, I completely could not come up with his name.
Oh, I get it.
And then I went in a very wrong direction. Also a bit of an impressionist painting, Munch, but nevertheless.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it's not a very helpful hint to say a very, very famous painter might be mentally quirky. That's literally most of them.
Was it Caravaggio? Is that the...
Yeah, I mean, they all got some issues in some form or another.
Yeah.
It's an artist thing, I guess. But do you happen to know offhand how Vincent died?
Oh, geez. Wow. I don't.
Okay.
Goodness, I don't. Is it mysterious death? It's not like... Did they think that he was involved? What was the one with Edgar Allan Poe? The where they would dress people up and get them drunk and send them voting for a candidate?
Yes, he's cooping.
Cooping, that was the term, yeah.
You know, when I picked this, it kind of reminded me a little bit of your Edgar Allan Poe choice that you made for our 10 Cities, 10 Mysteries episode, because there is a prevailing theory that has been with us since around his death.
Hold on, I got it. Ergot.
Yes, that's it.
That
explains the mental issues, right?
We finally got to it.
I feel like we're all just, you know, it's all ergot. Anytime it's just all crazy ergot and unexplained. The prevailing theory has been that it was a suicide.
Okay.
And that theory more or less took roots in the years, like kind of the immediate years following Vincent's death. But to lay the groundwork a little bit and really go to detail on Vincent somewhat, there's a long history there, and I'm not going to go into exhaustive detail, but to suffice it to say, apart from his paintings, Vincent was known for the struggles that he had mentally. And yeah. Some even say that the things that he saw, the way that he saw the world, is influenced through probably a lot of drinking, but also what he was dealing with, like the swirls in his paintings. You know, people say that is how Vincent likely saw the world.
Oh, wow.
There's a whole study on that.
Are they thinking like it's a synesthesia, or are they thinking it's more of like, is it like a, not a delusion, a hallucination, or just...
Very possibly some hallucinatory stuff. And in the last years of his life, he largely spent institutionalized. It's actually during this period that he did Starry Night, and some of his most famous work, in fact, was done during this period before he died. Now, the actual circumstances of his death were that he took his painting supplies, went out into this wheat field, and began painting it. And at some point, he comes stumbling back into town with a gunshot in his abdomen. When he was asked what and how it happened, they asked if he pulled the trigger, and he said yes, but he was very confused, and there was no gun found. They never found the pistol, like, that actually did it. And a lot of people were a little confused as to why he chose, if he was going to kill himself, why shoot yourself in the stomach and then come stumbling back into town?
Right.
The way that the story was put together, though, was they figured, yeah, he probably shot himself. It took him a long time to die, actually. Relatively speaking, he was gut shot, but the bullet missed any of his vital organs. It took him about 30 hours to pass away. So he slowly just festered this wound, and it just and then he died from it. The horrible way to go, unfortunately, for Vincent. Not long after his death, his work became very celebrated. He's one of the classic examples of the artist that was never appreciated in life. But around 2014 or so, a book came out that challenged this suicide story.
Oh, okay.
It was written by two Pulitzer Prize winning biographers, Stephen Neffe, I know I'm mispronouncing that, and Gregory White Smith. And they went to the source. They scoured it. They went to the official museum that's over in the Netherlands. They went into a special vault that had so many of Vincent's personal effects, like sculptures that he used as models and still lifes, and so many different things that, and his letters, all the letters that he wrote.
Okay.
And that should be noted, by the way, is that Vincent was a very prolific letter writer. He wrote a lot of letters. It was his thing. When he wasn't painting, he was writing a letter to somebody. And interestingly, there was never a suicide note. And this flies completely in the face of the way that previous movies have depicted Vincent's death. There was a movie that came out starring Kirk Douglas in the early 1950s. It was called Lust for Life, that depicted Vincent writing a tortured note and then going out into the wheat field, and then you hear a gunshot and the movie ends.
Yeah.
And it kind of infuriated people, because even though they accepted that he likely killed himself, that wasn't the way it was portrayed at all. Like, he survived the shot. He didn't leave a note. They never found anything. And in fact, the guy who started the whole suicide narrative, and the two authors of this book, by the way, they, and the book title is Van Gogh, The Life, is the name of the book. So if you're interested in reading this theory, pick that up, and you can read a lot more. But there was a friend of Vincent's at the time who was always trying to curry favor with a local newspaper editor. and other editors to just try to like get his name out there a bit more. And so he would make things up.
Okay.
And largely he was the one behind the whole Van Gogh suicide story. And it, they just kind of like went with it. But there was all this other information that flew in the face of that. Like, for instance, a couple days before Vincent died, he had placed a massive order for new paint because right before then, his fortunes were actually starting to turn. He was actually getting really good reviews for his artwork for the first time ever. And so, in fact, that morning that he died, he wrote a letter to his brother talking about how optimistic he was feeling about the future. And then he stumbles back later that afternoon or that evening with a gunshot in his belly and loosely saying that he pulled the trigger himself. And people pretty much just bought that. And because they were like, oh, Vincent's crazy,
right,
you know?
Right.
And it was no secret whatsoever that this man struggled a lot. He cut off his ear. And that's the other thing he's most famous for, right? Other than his paintings is the ear thing. Like, that's probably the first thing people think of. And this, he didn't just cut a piece of the ear off. He cut off the whole motherfucking ear.
Okay.
He did not, you know, this wasn't a cry for help. This was somebody very mentally disturbed,
right,
at the time that he did it. So this is not at all to say that Vincent was not in the state of mind to take his own life. In fact, even I'm still in doubt about this myself, because for everything they bring up as reasons why he might not have done it, I continue to go back to what I know of suicide and the people who succeed at it, and that they often give no warning. They often seem very optimistic and very normal right before they do it.
Yeah.
And we're not looking for those clues. So, you know, we think everything's normal. So the fact that he ordered paint and wrote this letter, that doesn't mean that he didn't go out into that field and get kind of lost in his world of painting. And then the darkness came in,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because that's really all it takes, is that moment of falling into that pocket and not being able to get back out. Nobody's there to take you out of it. But here's the problem. Where did the gun come from? Because he sure as hell didn't have one.
Okay.
And so this is the thing that makes me pause and kind of like consider this theory a little bit. So the prevailing theory is that there is a man named René Secretan who remained completely silent. He lived in the town where Vincent died. And then he saw the film Lust for Life when it came out. It came out in 1956. And after he saw the way it was portrayed that he died, that's when he started to talk. And he confessed that he was essentially the town bully. And in fact, he led a gang of teenage troublemakers in the town who liked to get drunk and pick on Van Gogh. In fact, he got bullied quite a bit because he was different.
Right.
And also, he could be very temperamental and kind of an asshole. That was kind of like the other thing about it. He made himself a target. Then you have a group of teenagers and they're just looking to make trouble. Well, here's the thing. Our buddy René, he liked to dress up as a cowboy, Buffalo Bill, and brandish a pistol that he got from the local innkeeper where Vincent lived.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, yeah, nobody at the time that he died mentioned the word suicide. In fact, they only ever went so far as to say he wounded himself, which could be taken in any connotation.
Sure.
Like it was an accident, but, you know, that's wholly different from suicide.
Right.
Other people say, too, if you intend to kill yourself and you shoot yourself there, why come back to the town? That was the other question that was brought up. Again, I could step in as a devil's advocate and say, if you fail at suicide, oftentimes people that have failed at suicide will say that they regretted it the second that they did it. So the fact that he went back to town, if he did shoot himself, he might have had regret set in. Like,
yeah,
maybe I don't want to die. I need to go back and get help.
Right. That's a feeling I had, too. I was like, well, just because you go through it doesn't mean you wouldn't immediately regret it and then think, like, what the hell am I doing? Like, in a way, it's like a huge wake-up call because you're in the grips of a monster in your brain.
Yes.
You know, the monster of, like, shitty brain chemistry. And, you know, you're not thinking clearly in that moment, but something like that, it's almost like when you're driving at night and you start to kind of doze off and suddenly mm-hmm. you wake up and you're, like, completely alert because you're like, whoa, what the hell?
Yep.
It's almost like
yep.
that kind of a revelation.
Exactly. And you could imagine, too, that somebody who's mentally disturbed, especially... and he was known to be very mercurial. Like, he could very easily slip from almost a manic state of happiness and joy into a deep depression just at the drop of a hat. He very likely was bipolar.
I was going to just ask, do they think he was bipolar? Okay.
Yeah, there's a bit of that, or there could be some schizophrenia. And, you know, those two conditions tend to, blur together in
sure.
some ways. So the thing, too, though, is that the doctor couldn't really make sense of the wound, though. The doctors at the time, even after he died, they were like, this is a really awkward angle
yeah, what,
to shoot yourself.
What year is this again?
This is 1889.
Are they able at this point, forensically or whatever you would call it at that point in time, match that bullet to this guy who liked to dress up like a cowboy and carry around his pistol?
And in
pistol?
Fact, it does match the caliber.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And that a gun, a rusty revolver of that same caliber from that time period was auctioned for like something around $800,000 or some amazing sum because it was believed that this could be the gun.
Oh, wow.
But if it wasn't him, it was the type of gun that killed him. And they were able to, of course, probably look at the trajectory, you know, similarly to the way we do now. You stick a little probe down in there and you can kind of trace the path of the bullet and
yeah.
get an idea of, you know, how it went in. And this gun that Renee had, it classically misfired a lot. It was a really crappy gun, even at the time. And so the way that it's thought is that the roving band of hooligans, you know, led by this guy, you know, they're out there playing around and, messing around with Vincent, probably picking on him a little bit because he left his painting stuff set up and then apparently like walked a good distance away towards something. Maybe he went for a walk to take a break or relieve himself or whatever when he runs across this group of kids. And it's alleged that, you know, while they were messing with him, probably pointing the gun and, you know, doing yeehaw, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
The gun goes off and Vincent stumbles back and tries to ultimately, in a final act of martyrdom, say that he did it because he didn't want the kids to go to jail or
oh.
be implicated.
Interesting.
Because in many ways he was in very poor health. He knew he had thoughts. It's almost like, kind of like a, well, I wanted to die anyway.
Yeah, like you did but, for me what I couldn't do for myself. Like if he was really
yeah.
thinking like, yeah, interesting.
And this book goes into a lot more other details. And there's also a great Vanity Fair article that I will post that it was actually written by the authors of the book that talks about all the research that they've done, and they add this whole theory, the accidental shooting theory, to sort of like the appendix of the book so that people can read through it in particular and decide for themselves what they think. But it certainly seems like the suicide theory was puffed up and not very well supported back then. It was just one of those things that somebody said to the newspaper because they were desperate for attention.
Right.
It makes sense because Vincent's crazy. And then people just believe it. And that just becomes the story. And the thing is, that particular story of his suicide actually is largely what propelled him even further into celebrity and infamy posthumously, because it's all part of that narrative, right? Whereas if he'd been accidentally shot in the gut, it's just not, it's not as, you know, good, you know, in terms of the dramatic arc
yeah,
of
yeah.
it. So you can almost see how, like, it's just the better story and that's the one we're going to run with. And then much later, somebody comes out and says, hey, I was there. I may or, well, he, the guy who, the Rene guy, he doesn't take credit for the shooting at all. Actually, he doesn't go that far. So in his own accounts of it, but between like people in the town and all these other things are able to like piece together, like, huh, you were there. Something's up. Right. Something happens between Vincent and someone else. And he ends up dead. So I had never considered this theory before. I, you know, was aware that Vincent died of suicide, or that's what I thought. Never questioned it, never looked deeper into it, really. And then when Brett, the question that he sent back was Van Gogh murdered? I was like, whoa. Okay. So apparently something did happen in the Netherlands at one point.
Yeah.
So yeah, the most, pretty much arguably one of the most famous painters of all time, that is, was, has been sold as this eccentric, troubled man. Did he or did he not take his own life? And, question mark. I still lean suicide, but I do question the logistics of the gun.
Yeah.
Why didn't he have it? Nobody knew him to have a gun. Why didn't he bring it back with him?
Right.
Why didn't he say where it was? He could have, you know, said, oh, I left the gun out in the field. It's out there. Somebody might have stolen the gun, I guess. But I just feel like maybe he would have tried to do it near where he was painting, not, you know, around, like, farther away. I don't know. So yeah, those little logistical things stick with me, but the question and the mystery is there is did Vincent Van Gogh kill himself or was he murdered?
It's just so interesting. Like, yeah, there's so many parallels to Edgar Allan Poe as well. And just this whole idea of like this narrative that's been there for so long, you know, new information comes out where all of a sudden it puts that narrative into question. You're like, oh, okay. Like, this is another tempting explanation, and they each have their pros and cons. And, you know, absent that full information, we're just left to kind of speculate and wonder. But you also have that bias of like, well, this has been the narrative all along. So it kind of gets some immediate credibility that then has to be pretty convincingly overcome for someone to be able to say, okay, well, maybe this other theory, maybe theory B, right, is actually the real one, when for so long, that's, you know, in books, in articles, in storytelling in general. No, he killed himself. Well, maybe. But
you know,
maybe
and
not.
What's really fascinating, too, are the people that work in those main museums, those curators, those people that have devoted their life to the study of this man. When they were confronted by these biographers with this theory, when they said, what do you think? They were very like, yeah, that's kind of a quiet thing we sort of like mentioned. We don't necessarily quite buy the suicide thing.
Okay, interesting. Huh.
And so there's some of that. But then also to keep in mind, too, culturally, especially at that time, suicide was probably even more taboo then because of the religious implication, right? That it is a mortal sin.
Right.
So I feel like people would have been reluctant to say that he killed himself because they didn't want to damn him to hell, right? So that could be part of it. There are so many good reasons to, or arguments to refute this theory, but there are certain things in this theory that don't wash away very easily. So it's well worth the dive down the rabbit hole, and I recommend people check it out. So, and thank you, Brett, for the idea. You saved my butt that day. So I think I'd been spending like an hour looking for something. I'm like, what is with this country? It's so perfect. Oh, Vincent Van Gogh was murdered. Okay, that'll work.
Some of these countries are actually harder than I expected to find like this enduring kind of mystery for. It was a little surprising, and maybe it's just too broad of a, like, to search for a country versus like a state or a city or whatever, you know, within a country. Like, if you just say like United States mysteries, I don't know what would pop up, quite honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe like, God.
JFK assassination?
Maybe. Or, you know, you could go back a little further. Maybe the Charles Lindbergh baby kidnapping, you know, something like that. But yeah, there's
Amelia Earhart, like, maybe. Yeah.
Amelia Earhart. Absolutely. Yeah. We have a few, but yeah, some of the countries are you know, or their mysteries are a little more buried in folklore, like the South African one that you told us last week. Right. So there are mysteries abound. And I really loved our time in the wheat field trying to suss out the death of one Vincent van Gogh. But we got to get back on the plane, man.
Where to now? Are we going to be jet lagged? Are we flying far?
Not too terribly far, I guess. You know, it's probably maybe about a couple hour flight. We're heading, my friend, to Deutschland.
Finally, we've talked about Germany a lot. Now we actually get to Germany proper for a German mystery.
A proper German mystery.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, Germany, on the flip side, has no shortage of mysteries to sort from. But this one, and it's funny, it wasn't until I started looking at my notes, like, as a whole earlier, and noticed that I seem to be finding a theme for some of these things.
Oh.
And that is one of the solitary man who ends up dying very mysteriously and nobody knows how or why.
Okay.
So we had Peter Bergman last week. Van Gogh can kind of fit in that framework too. Sure,
absolutely.
And now we're going to talk about a man named Günter Stoll.
Oh.
And we're going to 1984. So we're jumping forward about a century here.
Oh, when's the Berlin Wall come down?
88, 89, somewhere. So we're still in occupied Cold War Germany here. And so we're near the end of that year. And he was a German food technician. And he also was suffering from some paranoia and some delusional, possibly, thoughts. This will kind of give you some vibes of Ray Rivera, the way. He started, when he would talk to his wife, he started talking about them, like them this and they, like they were after him. Like he started talking that way, right? And his wife was like, who the hell are you talking about? And then one evening, it would get even worse. So I don't know if you are familiar with the term Yogtze, Yogtze.
No.
No, see, this is the word. I'm familiar with
Yahtzee, the game Yahtzee.
Yahtzee, but yeah, we love Yahtzee.
Yeah.
This is the word that haunts this story.
Okay.
So this is what makes people wonder if his paranoia was based on something real or if it was part of the delusion.
Oh, okay.
And so Yahtzee, it's all caps, okay? Yogtze. On the night of October 25th, he was seated in a chair when out of the blue, he stands up and proclaims, oh man, my German is so rusty, but Jetzt geht mir ein Licht auf, which roughly translated meant I get it, or now I understand, or Eureka, you know,
Eureka moment.
He had a literal Eureka moment.
There's another case where this happens. Is it Logan Scheindelman?
Oh, really? In a German?
No. It's actually here in the US, but it's one of those cases where I think someone ends up, he's either missing or murdered, but he basically is like, Mom, I want to talk to you tonight. I have it all figured out.
Oh, I know that case.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking
Logan
about.
Logan Schneidelman or Schindelman. It's something like that. But anyway, I got that vibe as soon as you said those words. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This one is definitely fitting in that mold for sure. And so after he has his Eureka, he goes over, grabs a piece of blank paper, and scribbles down the letters Yahtzee. But some people think the G could be a number 6 because, and there's a picture of, if you do a Google of this, of that word, you will see the note and what it looks like. Because there's like an extra character after the G, and it's hard to tell if it's an apostrophe or some other random mark. But after he wrote this down, he left the house in his Volkswagen Golf and was next seen arriving at his local pub. He orders a beer and they set it down. But before he could take so much as a sip, he apparently fell to the floor and hits his head really hard on the floor. Like he's just in no good condition here. But they didn't think he was drunk. Like he wasn't acting intoxicated. It was almost like he was so agitated and distressed and anxious about something that he, who knows? But they said it wasn't intoxication. There was something else going on with him.
Okay.
There had been no sign of Gunther for a couple hours. And then he turned up around 1 o'clock in the morning at the house of an elderly woman he'd known since childhood. And it was so late, though, that she wouldn't open the door for him and told him to go home. She's like, get the hell out of here, you know? And he said he'd go home, but he mentioned some horrible incidents would take place that night. 2 hours later, around 3 a.m., a pair of truck drivers found a badly damaged Volkswagen in a ditch along the Autobahn A45. And one driver headed for the closest red side emergency phone while the other examined the car. And inside, they found Gunther still barely alive. And he was completely naked. And he managed to reveal that there had been 4 passengers in the car with him just before the truck drivers found him. He said that all 4 had fled, but they were not friends. Witnesses were still trying to figure out the details when the ambulance arrived. But unfortunately, he died on the way to the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's just getting weirder and weirder.
Yeah.
So they started doing the investigation whenever they started running into all these weird mysteries and puzzles. They found that the cause of death was vehicular manslaughter. But the car that hit him, however, was not Stoll's own car. Investigators believe that someone had run over Gunther someplace before the perpetrator took him and put him in his car and then put that car in a ditch.
Oh, okay.
So he was run over. And this is another one that's kind of reminding me of the Murdoch case. There was the kid, his name was Stephen Smith, where he was found lying in the middle of the road.
That's right.
And they thought that he'd been thrown out, but it looked like he had been beaten to death and placed there.
Right.
So again, we have like a different manner of death and then he was moved and put in. So that takes someone else to pull that off. So investigator questioned various truck drivers, the truck drivers that found him, and they revealed that they saw a stranger not far from the Volkswagen when they pulled up. This man, whoever he was, they said he had a bright jacket on and was walking around the wrecked car. And the stranger had disappeared sometime between the discovery of the car and the emergency call that the truck driver made. And the 4 men that Gunther said were in the car with him have never been identified. The actual crime scene has never been located, and no one really knows what Stoll meant in that note, the Yahtzee thing. What the hell does all that mean? Some suggestions do think that there could be some additional clues like that that actually does tie to something. This is where the Ray Rivera thing comes in for me, because remember the notes that he left taped to his computer?
Oh, yes.
And they were like really nonsensical and stuff.
Oh, yes.
Kind of giving me that vibe where it only makes sense to him because he's going through a psychotic break.
This is probably a bad example, but it reminds me of when... And I've done this before, where I've woken up in the middle of the night with the most brilliant idea ever, and I've scribbled it on like a sticky note. Mm-hmm. And I woke up the next morning and I was like, what on earth was I thinking? Like, what is this?
Yes.
I think there's even a Seinfeld bit about it. Like one of the earlier seasons of Seinfeld where like he writes something down. He's like, what does that even mean? What is this? I've had that kind of thing. And in the moment, it's a revelation. And you just have to wonder if it was something that was mental illness, or it was a hallucination, delusion, you know, something like that where he wasn't in the right state of mind. You could think something very nonsensical makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Like a dream. It's almost like a dream where you're like, oh, this is so profound in the dream. And you wake up and you're like, no, it's not. But it feels like a revelation as you're waking up, like I've uncovered the secrets to the the truth of existence or whatever.
I have been hit by story ideas also, like whole plots just like fall into my head and I go and I scribble them down before I can forget. And then I go back and read them later and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And not even in a sleep state. It's just more like I've been seized by this brilliant idea in this moment. And maybe I was stressed out, or maybe I was tired, or maybe I was a little drunk or something like that, where I wasn't in my normal frame of mind.
Yeah.
And then once you come back to it in that frame of mind, you're like, wow, I was really having a moment there.
Yeah.
So the note is to me, you know, because it's really the only clue we have to anything. Well, it's the only forensic clue, because it sounds like I don't think they found any fingerprints or anything like that.
Okay.
No indication there were four other people in that vehicle?
No,
which is
like
a small vehicle to have five people jammed in there, right?
I agree. It's a Golf, so that's a two-door. It's usually a hatchback. I mean, you have to cram three people in the back of that and one in the passenger seat. That's a struggle, and I've been in plenty of Golfs. But the note, like, here's some theories that people have to say, other than the possible mental break. Some theorize it could be a license plate number, and that the O might have been the number zero. And the number two may have been misidentified as the letter Z. It could have been a two. And the six could have been mistaken for a G.
Was there any way to, like, historically or whenever that was thought up, go and check, you know, database records?
I couldn't find, and that I think would be make for a fun investigation,
right?
You know, if we wanted to do a deeper dive on this, because I'm like, well, okay,
was it a German license plate? Well, I guess we wouldn't know that.
It could
right?
have been, right? I mean, I'm very curious about that, like if there is a license plate that relates to that. Other people say, though, that Y06TZE is a call sign for a Romanian radio station and might have been the true meaning of the note. This does seem to be nothing more than a coincidence, though, with no real ties to what took place that night. And he was a food engineer by trade. It's funny. That makes me think of Breaking Bad. Remember the chicken nugget guy eating the chicken nuggets? He works for the food company, German.
Yeah, right.
I'm just like, that's interesting. Was it that guy? Is he in the meth trade?
Right.
What's going on there? It feels more like a coincidence. But say that because he was a food engineer, the first three characters meant nothing at all. Oh, some say that TZE is a flavoring that's often used in yogurt. And some people are really breaking this apart because he was a food engineer, that maybe he wrote down some formula what he, like, something to develop.
Wait, isn't there a yogurt that's like tzatziki or whatever?
Oh, that tzatziki is a yogurt sauce, like a Greek yogurt sauce.
Yeah.
Like, it could be.
That was just a grocery list. Yog? Yeah. It was his abbreviation.
He found out what he wanted to have for dinner that night, was going to go to the grocery store, was kidnapped by four guys, run over with a car, put in his own car. I think we cracked this one.
Hold on. There's tzatziki. Oh, okay. It's like a soup or a dip or a sauce. Middle Eastern. Yeah. Diluted yogurt. I'm just saying. Maybe the dude was just starving. I'm just...
He wanted a gyro, you know? I mean, and I couldn't blame
don't
him.
Don't we all? Don't we all? Sorry, not to make light of this, but I'm just I'm just wondering, like, it's...
I mean, when we're talking about these crazy theories, it's like, well, this seems about as valid as some of this other crap.
Right.
And some people are saying it's an anagram. So the word zygote is an anagram of this.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know why that would matter. People are stretching this too far, saying, like, is this related to some sort of genetic modification of food ingredients or whatever? And he was murdered. I mean, come on. Give me a break.
Interesting.
The more plausible story that some people say is that he was possibly sitting at home, thinking over things in his head, when he came to a sudden realization that someone was possibly doing some kind of, it was probably a work-related thing, that there was like something going on at the food factory where he was working, and they suspected possibly that he was a whistleblower. I mean, and that's the thing, is when they were talking about they're after me, they're dealing with me, like there might have been something going on at work.
Oh. Okay.
Let's see. When Stoll arrived at the pub, he may have seen someone that caused him to react. Perhaps at this point, that's when he fell and hit his head. And maybe one of the four men he mentioned followed him out of the pub shortly before he succumbed to the car accident. I don't know. There's a lot of weird stuff, but they've never really gotten to the bottom of the fact that he was killed outside the car, put in the car, and the car was abandoned. It's very possible that in his agitated state, maybe he was wandering in the street and got hit by a car and somebody put him in, you know, to cover it up, put him in the car and, you know, tried to conceal their hit and run kind of situation.
Right.
That's kind of my theory on this. But there really hasn't been anything else about this case that has, you know, solved it. So, but Y-O-G-T-Z-E. Remember that. It might be important, guys. I mean, I'm just putting out a clue. You know, maybe it still means something, but it kind of is like the Croatoan, to kind of harken back right. to mentioning the colony, Roanoke.
Yeah.
It's one of those words that has like impact and meaning. Actually, Croatoan is kind of like wild. You can go down a rabbit hole on that word and find all kinds of weird things.
Yeah, it gets very imbued with perhaps much more meaning than it actually has, but it's like a last message. It also reminds me of the Dyatlov Pass incident, where Rimpel was like the last mm-hmm. entry. And that was the name of, I think, a hunter that they had seen in the area, like a Mansi hunter at some point. And they're like, oh, I was dying and Rimpel came and killed us all. And I was writing, you know, like I scrawled his name right. as my final clue to the world of what happened to us. Or it's probably nothing like that at all. But it's like when you're left with that kind of a thing, it's this undecipherable set of letters or numbers or whatever. You're just left to like really pore over it because it's all you have, or, you know, one of the few things you have. So
it's really interesting though, that he talked about the horrible incident to that old woman that he tried to visit from his childhood. And then, you know, to have this happen. And then, you know, what's interesting too, is apparently he used to take a lot of regular trips to the Netherlands.
Okay. Which,
where I did say nothing happens in the Netherlands, but maybe.
Well, who knows? It sounds like Germans make things happen in other countries. So they're
Norway.
They're going to Norway. Yeah, Denmark. So
I think Germans just like to go to that part of the world. You know, that's like every country seems to have its Florida. I always just call it it's Florida, just because like we're that place you flock to on holiday. Yeah. You know, Englanders have Spain.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have Florida. Well, the West Coasters usually have like Vegas or California or something like that.
But yeah.
Maybe for Germans, it's Norway or Sweden or some Netherlands. I don't know. So there are a lot of mysteries like this. And as I was reading it, I was like pinging all the ones that we do know about, like Ray Rivera, or, oh, there was one that the prosecutors did where the guy who's in Texas, but he goes missing. He ends up being found in Yakima, Washington, wearing military garb, being hit by a car in the middle of the road. And they identify him, and he had been missing for like 10 years.
Oh,
and they found him in the middle of Yakima.
Oh, like, wild. I don't remember that story. That's,
yeah.
Did I miss that yeah, one? Wow.
I'll have to look. You might. I'll send that one to you later. But there's so many like this yeah. where so many weird clues. And it's like, if it's a mental break, then I get that. But how do they so easily get from point A to point B and put this whole elaborate thing together? It's like things that kind of fly in the face of disordered thinking with it. So I don't know. But these kind of cases stick with me probably almost more than any other in terms of like missing persons mysteries and murder mysteries. It's those, or like the woman who went missing in New York and they found her at the top of a mountain in North Carolina in hiking garb, you know, and she was at a work event in the middle of the city. Like, how did she end up all the way up
right.
there? I just, you know, just things like that. It's just like, what is going on
right.
In this world that this can happen? But that, my friends, is Deutschland.
All right. Vielen Dank, Deutschland.
Indeed, indeed. But now,
yeah.
I'm turning it over to Chris.
Yeah, vielen Dank und auf Wiedersehen. Tschüss. We are back on that airplane, man. And we're flying to the Great White North. We are making our way to Canada.
Oh, America's hat.
Our home Yay. And native land. Okay, so Canada, you're coming in at number three, supporting the show. Shout out mm-hmm. to our Canadian listeners and friends.
Thank you very much.
And this is one where Canada had like 70 trillion mysteries. And I was like, I want to do them all. They were all amazing. I had the opposite struggle here where I could not land on the mystery I wanted to go with. And I came really close to doing a different one, but I said, you know what? I got robbed of my Kruger Millions in South Africa.
Yes.
I'm doing an old-fashioned money heist.
Oh, well, you know me. I love me a heist.
And what is better than the Toonie truck heist of 1996?
You know, I may have researched this one when I was doing my little heist episode a few weeks back. All right, do tell me. Yeah, I'm excited to hear this because it was probably on one of the lists I was looking at.
Canada has seen its fair share of big time and I would say colorful heists, from looted lobster to blueberry bandits, from maple syrup mayhem to purloined lettuce.
Oh, yeah.
Not to mention the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts skylight caper. That's one I almost did.
Ooh, I don't think I know about that one.
Yeah. And perhaps the only busted theft has been the fruitless hundreds-year strip mining of Oak Island by would-be treasure hunters. Trying to find all that gold, where unlike that Swedish island, they ain't found shit there. So
No.
That ain't gonna stop nobody from digging more holes and making more shows.
Exactly.
But yeah, why make the perfect heist about pirate booty rarer than a $2 bill when you can steal the $2 bill? Well, the $2 coin, that is.
Ah, very interesting.
But yeah, this was no mere pickpocketing scheme, rather a $3 million payday of freshly minted $2 coins.
That's a lot of coins.
Which would become known as the biggest coin theft in Canadian history, which I'm going to put an asterisk there because I have a joke that's actually true about the biggest coin theft in Canadian history. It's February of 1996. Canada releases their $2 coin, affectionately referred to as the Toonie, the $1 coin called the Loonie.
Oh. Loonies. See, and I know about that. I know about loonies and toonies, but I didn't know actually what they were.
Yeah.
So you've answered that question for me.
So the toonie came out in 96. A little bit, I didn't realize it was that much of a recent introduction into their currency. So a mere 5 months later, after these are released unto the Canadian population, $3 million worth of newly minted currency is stolen from the Turcotte Yard in Montreal.
Oh boy.
And what's even more interesting is it was done in broad daylight. So the thieves struck during the lunch hour on a weekend. They entered a railroad yard in central Montreal during the day, found a tractor trailer amongst many tractor trailers that were parked there, carrying 1.5 million $2 coins, and drove off. So there's a lot of speculation. They knew what they were doing. They knew how to find this diamond in the rough, so to speak.
They had a tip from the, probably the inside.
Right.
Maybe. Yeah.
The thieves drive the truck out of an emergency exit. And what's crazy is no one really knows what's going on for a while. But by the time they're onto something being fishy, the abandoned vehicle is located in the suburbs, and all the money is gone. Somehow, these thieves moved 60 metric tons of coins.
Okay, so that was my question, was how much does all this weigh? Because a coin is not light when you get them all together.
Yeah, especially when you have 1.5 million of them.
Yeah.
And there's not a trace of them in this big truck. So clearly this was a lot of planning. Now, I don't have a good sense of the time frame between when the truck is stolen and when it's found. Mm-hmm. But still, that is a Herculean effort to move all of that coinage so quickly. So authorities will not say whether it's an inside job, but there has to be some kind of tip or something.
It often is. Security guards often will share a seat, if they're feeling a little disillusioned, that's usually how it happens.
It's almost always a security guard, quite honestly. And a lot of these I was reading, I'm like, security guard was in on it. Security guard was in on it.
Very much.
As I mentioned, there were a lot of similar trucks on the lot that day, which along with the fact that the coins were unmarked makes apprehending the guilty party or parties very unlikely.
Oh, my God.
Montreal Police Chief Inspector Robert Picard said it could be harder for the thieves to unload the toonies than it had been for them to steal them, given the high-profile nature of the theft. But again, so if someone's throwing, thousands of toonies around, you might kind of, got a lot of coins there in your pocket, buddy. But otherwise, they're untraceable. There's no way for them. They're not marked. There's no way for the individual coins themselves to go back. It would just be the fact that there could be people out there with wheelbarrows full of toonies.
Yeah, it's sort of like the inverse of, you know, in Shawshank Redemption when he's carrying pieces of the wall out into the prison yard when he's digging his tunnel. It's sort of like, yeah, just take a few coins and maybe convert them into cash. Just like here and there, here and there.
Yeah, we'll go to this bank and we'll, you know, convert them into whatever, or, you know, deposit them into a bank account and kind of sprinkle them out. But you have to imagine... One and a half million. The little coin sorter.
Would you look at that? I found $80,000 worth of toonies.
Oh, goodness. So Picard said that they gave information to all the police departments across Canada. News of the theft was made public days later. Financial institutions have been given similar notice. So it's basically like... the populace, the banking community, police departments, be on the lookout. Was that Bolo?
Yeah, Bolo.
Yeah.
That's it.
But again, prospects are not very good. According to Jean-Pierre Tremblay, vice president of manufacturing for the Canadian Mint, again, there's no way of tracing the toonies because they are not even numbered.
Wow.
And here we are today. As far as I could tell, still... no sense of who these thieves were and where they went to.
I mean, when the currency is unmarked, it's as good as gone for the most part, unless you can catch the thieves and sort of twist their arm enough to give up some of the loot. There was a Northern Ireland bank heist, very similarly. In fact, they got away with millions and millions of pounds, but they... never found any of it ever again, like very small amounts. I mean, so many of these big heists like that, it's very rare you get it all back, if any, but the risks are massive. So
yeah, absolutely. Unlike stealing like art, where, you know, if it's a piece of art, that's very traceable because it's probably, you know, a one of a kind, especially if it's from somebody who's very well known. And so...
and if there aren't too many people involved in it either. So it usually it falls apart if you have like a big team. Usually some people start to break or get stupid and reckless with the spending and all that. Because that's the thing, is even if it's untraceable, if you start putting a lot of money in a bank, you know, that gets noticed. So you have to be careful about how you spend it and how you dole it out. If you start spending big amounts of money, but you can't back that up with receipts and income, then the government's looking at you like, where'd you get that money? So yeah. And imagine like living with 1.5 million coin. You're Scrooge McDuck swimming in this motherfucking thing, but you can't do anything with it.
An actual, you know, money bin you're swimming in. Yeah. And that's the thing that's really interesting, is I've not even seen speculation if they have a guess as to how many people could realistically offload that, and that nobody saw it happening. Like, to offload 1.5 million coins, I don't know what they were packaged in and what that looks like, but the fact that this all happened and nobody saw anything, at least the, again, that we're aware of, that's been reported, just so like, it's almost unthinkable that this could happen, and there's nothing to show for it.
It's sort of like Vern from Stand By Me with his, you know, jar of pennies. There's people out there digging holes looking for jars of toonies on like all across Canada.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
Well, this led to a side story that's not really a mystery, but it's just a funny little companion story that I had to include it because I made the joke that this toonie heist was the biggest coin theft in Canadian history. But what happens if somebody steals one coin that weighs itself? This is a Canadian coin that weighs, get this, 100 kilograms. That's 220 pounds.
A single coin.
A single coin. A Canadian coin was actually stolen. You get one guess as to where it was stolen.
Where it was stolen from? Toronto? I don't know.
Germany!
Oh, are you kidding me? I was trying to think within the country. Of course, the Germans are in on all of this.
Germans come back. Okay, this is the saga of Canada's stolen $1 million coin. So I'm going to do a quick overview because this was hilarious to me. This is a massive medallion made of the purest gold bullion ever refined. It's worth anywhere I've seen $4.3 to $5.8 million, and it was stolen from the Bode Museum in Berlin and has never been found.
It's never been found?
Well,
that thing got melted down. You friggin' know.
100%.
Man.
Yeah. Actually, that's the very much evidence that that happened. So the coin was produced in Ottawa in 2007. It was an entrant into this ongoing international coin measuring contest between national mints, which there's a lot of measuring jokes here I have, but yes. You're obviously thinking as well.
Yep. Yeah.
So these national mints are basically just doing some one-upmanship. And a few years prior, an Austrian mint had created 15 massive coins that were 99.99% pure gold. They weighed 30 kilograms each, and they were valued each at 100,000 euros.
Oh, wow.
So the Canadian mint is just like, you know, hold my Molson Ice. So they
– My Labatt.
Hold my Labatt. So – So they want to, you know, get the bragging rights. So they make a 100-kilogram coin. Again, it's 220 pounds. It is 60 centimeters across. That's just under 24 inches across.
I was curious. It's like a manhole cover.
Basically, featuring the regal profile of Queen Elizabeth on the front. And
of course,
what's on the back?
A leaf.
A maple leaf. Of course, there's a maple leaf on the back.
Yeah.
All right. So not only was this coin much bigger and much heavier, but apparently it was 5/9 pure. So go back to our Breaking Bad reference. 99.999 gold pure.
Wow. Walter White. And it wasn't blue.
It was not blue. And so this was their coin, and apparently they ended up making 5 of these.
Oh.
One of them goes to this museum in Berlin. March 2017, 3 thieves apparently climbed through a malfunctioning window into the museum, capitalizing on a tip from a 4th suspect who worked as a security guard at the museum.
Oh, yes.
They move in. They swipe the coin from the glass encasement, lift it through the window using rope, and then they wheelbarrow the big maple to their getaway car. Without triggering a single alarm, this massive coin, again valued somewhere between $4 and almost $6 million, is gone. Now, the thieves are tracked down, arrested. They're eventually put on trial, and they are sentenced to prison. Not for a long time. We've talked about this in other countries. Prison sentences are not the same as they are in the U.S. The coin is yet to be found, but the prosecution believed it had been melted down or hidden. But they really think it's melted down because they found traces of gold dust. There were internet searches on the suspects that talked about melting down coins. And shortly after this, they were out making some big ticket purchases. So by all accounts, this one sister coin of the set of 5 has been destroyed.
So what you're saying is there are 4 more left up for grabs.
I'm just saying that Ocean's 13, 14, whatever the next movie is.
Oh my gosh, gotta catch them all.
Gotta and then you like bring catch them together. Them all. So I just thought that was like a great companion piece of like literally Canada's biggest coin stolen.
And it's funny, again, we independently researched all of our stories on our own. We did not compare notes. It's so funny to me that we're running into more German connections.
Always the German connections, man.
Oh my God, Germany, you got your hands in so many cookie jars.
That's right.
Yep. So we are now... I will say the next country does have something in common. Actually, our 3 countries have something in common, the last 3, but this one is also part of the Commonwealth.
I was going to say the sun never sets on the British Empire. Is that what we're talking about? Yeah,
something like that. Yeah. Yeah. So where are we going next, Careers?
Well, we got a long flight ahead of us because we're going from Canada all the way to Australia.
Are we on Oceanic Airlines?
I hope not, because we're never going to make it. We are now on an invisible island in the middle of the Pacific. We're heading to our Aussie friends to talk about a very well-known case that's probably not going to be a mystery much longer, but I kind of had to talk about it for a couple different reasons. And that is the Somerton Man.
Yes.
Speaking awesome. Of men... who show up dead, with crazy clues and weird circumstances.
And nobody knows who they are.
And nobody knows who they are. Dot, dot, dot. We have to talk about the Somerton Man. This is considered an unparalleled mystery that has endured for 73 years in Australia.
Yes.
Now, you can do an entire podcast about this particular case. I actually found this from the Astonishing Legends podcast. We'll drop some references in the show notes. They ended up doing, I think, a four-part series on this case, and then they ended up doing a follow-up one. I think it was just last year in 2022, but we'll get to that. So what is the Somerton Man? Well, on December 1st of 1948, police are contacted after the body of a man was discovered on Somerton Park Beach, which is a suburb of Adelaide in South Australia. He's found lying in the sand on his back. His head is resting against the seawall. His legs are extended and his feet are crossed. It's believed the man had died while sleeping. Now, witnesses came forward, said the evening prior they had seen an individual resembling this man lying on his back in the same spot where his body was found later. Another witness came forward, this is almost a decade later, and reported that he and some friends saw a well-dressed man carrying another man on his shoulders along Somerton Park Beach the night the body was found.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, now the mystery is kind of compounding here. But it only gets more and more perplexing because Somerton Man had items that indicated American origins in his possession, including his jacket and a comb. Many of his articles of clothing had the labels removed. He wore no hat, which was unusual for the time. There was an era where, you know, men had their fedoras and dressed up, all that good stuff. He was clean shaven, well dressed, and his dental records could not be matched.
All right.
Okay. Kind of like with the case that you mentioned,
Peter Berkman.
The Peter Berkman case. We're getting some odd clues and some untraceable elements like, all right, things aren't kind of matching up. What is going on here?
Like maybe he's not from around here.
Well, and to that end, later a suitcase is found. I think it was at a train station. I forgot to write that down. And it's linked to this man, but ends up offering few, if any, clues. But it's also giving us more of this, like, these question marks because – I'm sorry, I misspoke. This was at the Adelaide Railway Station. And the labels are removed from the suitcase. Among its contents were items also not available in Australia, more clothes with ID marks removed, and a few of them had T. Keen or Keen written on them. And it was common at that time to label your clothes. But it was also common to buy clothes secondhand with the tags removed by the previous owner.
Yeah.
On one hand, you're like, well, this is a spy. The tags are removed. What's going on here? It was a common practice, but this T. Keen seemed to indicate, is that this person's name? Is this something that we should, you know, investigate? Well, there's an inquest into the man's death, and the coroner does, you know, an autopsy, looks into, you know, the body and seems to indicate poison may have been involved. Whether it's,
okay.
But it's unclear if it was administered personally or by someone else. Also seems to indicate the man was likely dumped at the site rather than died there just because there's like the scuff marks and the his clothing and such, you know, didn't seem like he was, you know, that he may have like stumbled or fallen or been attacked or whatever when he was at the beach.
True. It's like he's posed though. It was almost like makes you wonder if they kind of like propped him up and
yeah, the fact that he's kind of laying like he was there, taken, he's propped up, his ankles are crossed. Yeah,
he's got a bit of a siesta thing going on, you know, and it's like, okay, so that's interesting. It makes you wonder if they placed him like that. Yeah.
But the coroner notes that these are not conclusive findings. There's speculation involved here. Well, on further investigation, this is where things get interesting. At this inquest, a tiny piece of rolled up paper is found and it has the word Tommen Should printed on it. And it's found in a fob pocket sewn into the trouser pocket. So it's like a pocket in a pocket.
Okay.
I don't know if women's clothes have that, but men's clothes
sometimes.
Oh, the
little mini pocket?
Yeah.
Yep, I have one of those.
So it's found rolled up in that little fob pocket. And so they started looking into it. And this text The phrase means ended or finished, and it's actually found on the last page of a book called the Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam.
Oh.
And following a public appeal by police, the actual copy of the Rubaiyat from which the page was torn is located. So they find the book it was taken from.
Oh, interesting.
So apparently the theme of Rubaiyat is that one should live life to the fullest, have no regrets when it ends. There's some death, a lot of death imagery and stuff like that there. And the poem's subject led police to theorize, well, maybe this man committed suicide by poison. And this book had some special meaning or whatever. It was very important to him. But what's also interesting in this book is that there's handwriting found in the back of this particular copy of the Rubaiyat. And it's five lines of capitalized letters. Sound familiar? Yahxi?
Yahxi!
Presumed to be some sort of code. In fact, code experts, amateur code breakers, cryptographers are all called in to try to decipher these lines. But nothing is ever kind of successfully determined from these lines of capitalized letters.
I actually just looked that up. And yeah, that is so weird. What the hell?
So again, you've got all these odd little clues that are starting to stack up and you're like, what the heck is actually going on here? So there's so many different theories that are stacking up over the years, This mystery kind of continues. Well, let's go to a couple of people, Jessica Thompson and Alf Boxall. Mm-hmm. So there's a telephone number found in the back of the book. It belongs to a nurse named Jessica Ellen Thompson. She goes by Jo. She's interviewed by the police. She says, I don't know this man, and I don't know why his phone number would be in my possession. But there's some speculation that she's being a little evasive. So they take a like plaster impression of his shoulders and face, part of this autopsy or the inquest. And they actually show this plaster of the Somerton man to her. And apparently she's said to have quickly looked away and not look at it again. So she's saying she doesn't know who he is. This doesn't look familiar, but some of her behavior is seeming suspicious.
Yeah, especially if it's just a plaster cast or a death mask.
Yeah.
You know, if that's making her feel that way, it's sort of like showing someone the picture of a victim, you know, and like seeing their reaction.
Well, and she also reports that sometime in late 1948, an unidentified man had attempted to visit her and ask a next door neighbor about her. So there's this character that's kind of out there. It's just, things are just, again, kind of strange. Now, Thompson said that while she was working at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney during the Second World War, she had owned a copy of the Rubaiyat and had given it to an Australian Army lieutenant named Alf Boxall.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, well, as a result of this conversation, police suspect, well, maybe Boxall was the Somerton man. However, in July of 1949, Boxall is found in Sydney, and the final page of his copy of the Rubaiyat is intact. So the words Tom and Should is still in place. So very strange that a lot of these people involved have this same – I've never heard of this book before. I don't know if it was like the bestseller at the time, but
yeah.
Very fascinating that she had a copy of the book that this man was found with. But it's not the same copy as, you know, as we come to learn. And it doesn't seem that this man is Alf Boxall because he's alive and well.
I am very curious now about how popular the Rubaiyat is or was at the time.
Yeah.
Because that's so weirdly coincidental. It makes him feel all connected in some way.
And it doesn't end there. So we get some spy theories going on. There's a lot of spy espionage thoughts around this. You know, his death is at the time of heightened international tensions. It's really the beginning of the Cold War. There's this alleged secret code in this book. We have an undetectable poison. We can't identify the man. No dental records. Tags cut out of clothes, all the stuff we're kind of talking about. So there's this speculation that he was a spy. And that was sort of a, you know, I don't know if it's a prevailing theory, but definitely a theory. And more interestingly, there's at least two sites relatively close to Adelaide that would be of interest to spies. The Radium Hill Uranium Mine and the Woomera Test Range. which is a military research facility.
That sort of makes you think of like some of those Russian mountaineer incidents that are near testing sites. Like, what did you get into? You stumble into something.
Another theory concerns Boxall again, who was reportedly involved in intelligence work during and after World War II. And let's talk about Kate Thompson. She's the daughter of Joe Thompson. Again, that woman who is interviewed by the police.
The nurse, yeah.
Kate says her mother was that woman and that she told her that she had lied to them, that Joe did know the identity of the Somerton man and that his identity was also known to a higher level than the police force.
Oh, wow.
Kate suggests that her mother and the Somerton man may have both been spies, noting that her mother taught English to migrants, was interested in communism, could speak Russian, though it was never explained how or why she knew the language.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
So
there are a lot of dots to connect here.
A lot
here.
Of twists, a lot of turns, a lot of what have yous, a lot of strands to keep in the old Duder's head.
Old Duder's head, yep.
Okay, well, let's keep moving. The South Australian Police Historical Society still has hold of this plaster bust that was made, and it contains strands of the man's hair. So let's, going back to the bog people, we've got hair,
yes,
folks.
Absolutely.
And we want to try to identify perhaps some DNA. The problem is that he was embalmed with formaldehyde, which,
that
much like
that,
the acids that are in the bogs, destroy a lot of the DNA. Other evidence, like that brown suitcase, was destroyed in 1986.
Oh, man.
Apparently some witness statements have disappeared from police files over the years. So, you know, and with the passage of time, some of this evidence for further reexamination is gone. Well, there is a request to exhume Somerton Man's body as early as 2011 for DNA analysis. And that goes back and forth for a long time. But in 2019 was finally granted. And in May of 2021, the Somerton Man was exhumed.
You know, never give up. If that's not the moral of the story, I don't know what is, you know?
Yeah.
And nothing's ever set. This happened in the 40s, and here we are, end of the 21st century.
Yeah, and apparently the remains were in reasonable condition, and there is some optimism about the prospects of DNA recovery. Well, to that end, let's talk about Professor Derek Abbott, because this is where we really come into the home stretch of this case. In March 2009, University of Adelaide team, led by Professor Abbott, is attempting to solve the case by cracking the code. That's step one. Step two is proposing to exhume the body to test for DNA. So he's a big part of this. I'm going to mess this name up. Masej Henneberg is a professor of anatomy at University of Adelaide, examines images of Somerton Man's ears and found that his simba, that's the like upper ear hollow, is larger than his cavum, the lower ear hollow. And this is a feature possessed by only 1-2% of the Caucasian population.
Oh, very interesting. Okay.
Abbott separately consults dental records and concludes the Somerton Man had hypodontia, a rare genetic disorder of both lateral incisors, a feature present in only 2% of the general population.
Very interesting.
1 year later, in 2010, Abbott obtains a photograph of Jessica Thompson's eldest son, Robin. Again, this is the woman. Said she didn't know Somerton Man.
The nurse. Yes.
The potential Russian spy. So they get a photograph of the eldest son, Robin, clearly showing that he not only has a larger simba than cavum, but also hypodontia.
Oh my God.
The chance that this was a coincidence has been estimated to be between 1 in 10 million and 1 in 20 million.
Oh, not a coincidence.
So now the media suggests Robin Thompson, who was 16 months old in 1948, who unfortunately passed away in 2009, may have been a child of either Boxall or the Somerton Man, and was passed off as Prosper Thompson's son. That was Joe's husband.
Oh, so she was having an affair, possibly.
Or just masking the fact that, you know, this was the kid. And so, oh, no, this is my husband's son.
Right.
Well, okay. So it just gets wild. December 2017, Abbott announces they have three excellent hairs that are at the right development stage for extracting DNA that have been found on that plaster cast of the corpse. So this is before the body is exhumed, but they're able to, you know, take some of those hairs off the cast and try to make some analysis of it. Okay, so we're going to jump all the way to July 2022. This is where things kind of get crazy because we may actually have resolution on this case.
Amazing.
So Professor Derek Abbott, in association with genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick, claims that they have identified the man using genetic genealogy.
Of course, our new best friend in the crime-fighting world.
Solving all the things lately. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they believe that Carl Webb, who went by Charles, is the Somerton man. He was an electrical engineer and instrument maker, born in 1905 in Footscray, a suburb of Melbourne. So through the investigation, matches were found for descendants of two distant cousins of Webb, and they were able to obtain photographs of Webb and his brother, and they claim to resemble the Somerton man.
Okay.
We also find out that Charles was married to a woman named Dorothy, and apparently their marriage was not a harmonious one, largely due to Charles' personality. So again, we've got a little bit of the cantankerous, problematic person here, much like the, was it Alfred Packer? Remember Alfred Packer?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The cannibal.
Yeah. So he apparently lived a solitary life, had few friends, and he'd go to bed at 7 p.m. each night. He was moody, violent, and threatening, especially when facing defeat, even over the most relatively trivial matters. So quick to set off, didn't take a whole lot. He was fond of poetry and wrote several poems of his own, most of them on the subject of death, which he claims to be his greatest desire, according to Dorothy. Yikes.
Hmm.
Yeah. This would be consistent with that copy of the Rubaiyat, which is also, again, focuses on the subject of death. Dorothy does recall in one instance in 1946 in which her husband apparently attempted suicide with an overdose of ether. In September of 46, Dorothy ends up fleeing from her husband after years of physical and verbal abuse. He moves out in 47 and goes off the radar. There is no death record of him as of 2022.
It doesn't explain much at all other than who, like, his identity. Yes.
True. But well, here's something else we got. We got a little bit more here. So Charles's older sister, Frieda Grace, was married to Thomas Gerald Keene. Keene.
Oh, my God.
They had a son named John who died in World War II in 1943. John's possessions included items which imply he resided in the U.S. at some point. Frieda Grace and Charles lived 20-minute drive from each other, which would explain why the Somerton man was wearing clothes of U.S. origin and with the name Keene on them. They would have been handed down from his brother-in-law or nephew. Abbott's research also indicates Webb enjoyed betting on horses, which may explain the coded message as horse names.
That sounds very possible.
Yeah,
if you'd like to bet.
Abbott and Fitzpatrick believe Charles had serious mental health issues and was spiraling after losing four close relatives in 7 years.
Yeah.
His history and the autopsy findings suggest he did indeed commit suicide by poisoning himself. South Australia police have not verified the results, but say they are cautiously optimistic that Carl Charles Webb is indeed the Somerton man. What this does not explain, though, is all of the wild coincidences with the Thompson family and Boxall and all of that stuff. Like, that 1 in 10 million, 20 million chance. Like, that's what's so wild about this case is even if it is explained, and we may find out pretty soon that, you know, this is indeed verified, but there's so much of this that is still mind-boggling.
Right. And right. There's still a lot of mystery here.
Yeah.
Like, it goes well beyond. It shows, like, it takes more than just knowing someone's DNA profile.
Yeah.
Who that belongs to really know a person.
Like the Thompson family, the Rubaiyat connections, like the hypodontia and the size of the ears, and just there's all of this stuff that just, how did he have her phone number? Like,
on a book that is similar to one she has?
Yes, that she gave to a soldier. Like, it's just mind-boggling. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this case, even though there's a good chance, like I said, it's solved, is I think this is a great example of how fanciful narratives can take us to places where he's a spy. There's all of this intrigue. There's a changeling child being, you know, switcherooed. And there's all sorts of, like, you know, the rubaiyat is just making its way around this international spy. It's a code of conduct. I don't even know. There's all right. of this stuff here. But when the day is done, there's a pretty standard explanation as to who this man was, why he wasn't identified so quickly. And, I mean, he's, by all accounts, kind of a cantankerous asshole. And right, he was a right. troublesome person. He caused a lot of grief for others. He clearly had grief himself. Again, a lot like Alfred Packer, mm-hmm. kind of a bastard. And you can understand that, but it's like, absent that information, again, for the win, genetic genealogy, cracking shit left and right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But this for was sure. just a great example of sometimes in the absence of evidence, particularly for 7 decades that this is sprawled on, it's really easy to start thinking, you know, it's like the Dyatlov 9 case, radioactive Yetis, space aliens, crazy yep. government conspiracy cover ups. Those could be true, not the aliens or the Yeti, but you know, like the other things could be true, but like,
hey now.
But still, there's probably a very commonplace explanation for that particular mystery. The narrative has gotten away from itself. And so part of my interest in telling the story is it's fascinating, but also it's really easy to get carried away. But when the day is done, if we want to humanize it, there are people at the center of these fantastical stories. There are people who are affected by the death of these people, these victims, mm-hmm. these, you know, missing or murdered folks. And we can't forget that. So that's some right. of the reason I was like, oh, I have to do this case, even though it's probably a little on the nose for Australia. I kind of had to do it.
Well, it's interesting to, you know, these kinds of stories where when you finally can solve a case of who this person is and where they came from. And then you find out that this person is maybe not a great person. And so you have to wrestle with that trope of true crime where she lit up the room and, you know, just everybody loved her, had a million friends. And it's like, you know, a lot of the people who die and go missing are not easy to love. And that doesn't mean we don't fight to solve their case right. or tell their story. Because at the end of the day, we're all human and kind of messed up in some way.
I mean, there's people who have been looking for answers for, you know, the Maura Murray case is a great example of one where it's, I think we're at 18 years now or something mm-hmm. that she hasn't mm-hmm. been found. And, you know, remains were found at, was it Loon Mountain Lodge?
Yeah.
And there was some speculation. It was her. And I remember her sister said, like, you know, we want this to be Maura so we have peace. But if it's not, hopefully some other family can get peace.
Yes.
And so
yes.
even people who are still grieving tragic loss, ultimately, you know, are like, hopefully this will provide answers, some measure of comfort for someone who's been waiting for their loved one to come home, to be brought to rest.
Agreed. Like ruling it out, like a lot of people who maybe for many years thought they had a connection to the Somerton man, or maybe the Somerton man was somebody that they were missing. And even to clear that for them, to eliminate that as a possibility yeah. for people, I mean, allows them to focus on something else. So I love that they've gotten this far and we have a name, and, you know, I think that's a great thing. So I will be keeping my eye open for more updates on this one because, yeah, like I said, it's on the nose for Australia, but, you know, it's a damn good one. And Australia has some pretty wild mysteries and, you know, murder cases and serial killers. It's a pretty varied place with some really interesting cases.
And I'm going to guess Germans are involved at some point.
I was waiting for the German connection. Little disappointed. Well,
yeah, the closest I got was talking about World War II. But yeah, that's about it. So
I'm not going to let you down.
Okay.
Our final one.
All right. So we have arrived at our number. I mean, spoilers. The number one country is the U.S., but obviously we're not going to talk about the U.S. in this one.
We already did that.
So our number one non-U.S. country. What do we have? Drum roll, please.
God save the queen. I say queen still to this day. yes, the UK, ladies and gentlemen.
All right.
But my venture into this realm begins with a question rather than an answer. Okay. Who put Bella in the witch elm?
Oh, why do I know this question?
This is a grisly one, a little bit.
I know this somehow. I don't know. Okay. All right. Okay. Please talk. So I don't know.
Who put Bella down the witch elm? It's a piece of graffiti that appeared in 1944 after the discovery in 1943 of the skeletonized remains of a woman inside a witch elm tree in Hagley Wood, which is located in Worcestershire, England. I hope I pronounce Worcestershire.
Worcestershire.
It's like, I'm not drunk. I just sound like it when I say that. The victim.
Yeah, put the laundry in the Worcestershire.
The victim was estimated to have been murdered sometime in 1941. And so she'd been in there for about 18 months, they estimate. On April 18th of 1943, four local boys were palling around in the woods, probably looking to do some poaching or, you know, get some bird nests, you know, get some eggs out of some nests, just doing stuff out in the woods. And they are on an estate that belongs to this lord that lives out there. When they come across this large witch elm, W-Y-C-H, by the way, is the spelling. And the trees can sometimes grow to look kind of creepy. It's like the tree that we're talking about here that's involved in this is a very creepy looking tree. And, you know, they thought, though, when they found it, that it would be a good place to search for birds' nests. And so they start climbing the tree to look around. And as he climbed, he glanced down and saw that the trunk was hollow and that within that hollow was a skull. And he thought maybe it was an animal skull.
I'm sorry. Hard pause. What a fucking nightmare of a tree.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
This tree is something out of a nightmare. And of course, there would be a dead body inside it, right? When you look at that tree, you're thinking, oh, yeah, there's a dead body in there. It's like, did it grow that way after they put her in? It kind of like gives me a little chills.
It's weird that a tree can be so creepy. And of course, I mean, you think of like, you know, in Wizard of Oz, like the mean trees throwing stuff at you, you know, something like that. But yeah, this is...
like the movie Pan's Labyrinth, you know, you just like crawl in the cave underneath the roots and you end up in some crazy world. You know, it's just one of those trees.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when they looked closer at the skull, they saw there was human hair and teeth. And so, yeah, they realized that they were dealing with a person, but they were on the land illegally. So they just put it back. And ran away. They did sort of like a Stand By Me, but they weren't looking for a body, but they did decide to just leave the body. We'll call it an anonymous tip or something. But the elder of the boys decided to tell his parents what they had found. And so the police turn out and they open up the tree trunk and they find an almost complete skeleton with a shoe, a gold wedding ring, and some fragments of clothing. The skull was very valuable because it had tufts of hair attached to it. And also the teeth were all intact and she had a very distinct dental pattern. Mm. Her front teeth were a little crooked, a little prominent, you know. Then they start searching around the scene a little more. And this sounds like I'm setting up a damn ghost story. I swear to God. They found her hand buried in the ground, some distance from the tree.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, well, we might get back to that in a second. So they took the body to have a forensic exam. The coroner, James Webster, he established that this was a female who'd been dead for at least a year and a half, placing her time of death in or before October of 1941. And they also discovered cloth in her mouth, like a scrap of taffeta shoved into her mouth that suggests she might have died from suffocation. And from the measurement of the trunk in which the body had been discovered, he also figured that she had been placed in there when she was still flexible, like freshly killed, because there's no way they could have fit her in if she was
had like rigor mortis. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was killed and they stuck her in the tree, or maybe she was still alive. And she died in there.
Okay, I was going to ask, like, do they think that she was alive and put in there and couldn't get out? Like, was there any indication that she was trying to get out or something? Or
now, I will get to that part of my notes, but that is an interesting and a very good question. So they looked at the items of the body, but there were so many people that were reported missing this around this time, because this was during World War II,
yeah,
or around the starts of it. So kind of a tumultuous period for searching people, and a lot of records by this point had already been destroyed, and there were just too much going on to really do an identification of right. her. And so they cross-referenced a lot of things with missing persons and what they knew of her and the items that she had on her, but none of it really seemed to match. And they also contacted every dentist they could, because she had a very distinctive bite, but they never found that either. And so then in December of 1943, that's when the graffiti message, "Who put Bella in the witch elm," appeared on a wall in Upper Dean Street in Birmingham. It actually read, "Who put Lubella down the witch elm in Hagley Wood?" And this gave investigators a lot of leads, because they were wondering, Bella, is this really her name?
Right.
Or was this like maybe a reference of, like, a lot of people say, is her name Lubella, or are they saying Bella because she's a woman, beautiful woman,
right,
you know, that kind of, a lot of people use like Bella in the, to mean a woman. And then in the 70s, they found a similar graffiti that was nearby where she was found, on like an obelisk, either some kind of a marker, grave marker, where somebody put the same question, who put Bella in the witch elm? And what's really interesting is that they have actually commissioned somebody to rebuild her face based on pictures of the skull and stuff like that. But unfortunately, the skeleton is missing.
Oh.
The skeleton is no longer among us, and they don't know what the hell happened.
Oh, goodness.
To said skeleton. So who the hell is this person? There's theories. There's a lot of theories. In 2014, Radio 4 over there in England did a broadcast where a reporter suggested two possible victims. One was reported to the police in 1944 by a Birmingham sex worker. In the report, she stated that another sex worker called Bella, who worked on the Hagley Road, had disappeared about 3 years previously. And the name Bella, or Lubella, suggested the graffiti writer was probably aware of the identity of the victim. So that's a very cut and dry
sure.
theory.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm liking that one, but we can't know for sure because we don't have her skeleton anymore. A second possibility came from a statement made to police in 1953 by one Una Mossop, in which she said that her ex-husband, Jack Mossop, had confessed to family members that he and a Dutchman called Van Rout had put the woman in the tree. Mossop and Van Rout met for a drink at a pub in Hagley. And later that night, Mossop said the woman became drunk and passed out while they were driving. The men put her in a hollow tree in the woods in the hope that in the morning she would wake up and be frightened into seeing the error of her ways. That is the worst wingman move ever.
Old, like, Scared Straight, like a precursor to Scared Straight or something.
Yeah, man. It just goes to show, only get wasted with really good friends. Don't, because, man.
That one doesn't ring as much true, but, like, it just sounds like right. somebody being kind of like a drunken, you know, smart ass of like, oh, yeah, we did it, and, you know, telling some bullshit tales or whatever. But, okay.
Yeah, what's interesting is that Jack Mossop, he was confined to a mental hospital because he kept having recurring dreams of a woman staring out at him from a tree.
Jesus Christ.
he died in the hospital before the body was actually found. So the likelihood of this being the explanation, though, is questioned because apparently Una, his wife, did not come forward with the information until more than 10 years after Jack's death. So, I mean, I don't know. That's one of those things that people keep to themselves.
Sure.
Another one. And here is where, when we were talking about the interesting fantastical theories here involving spies and what have you. This is another theory. Comes from a declassified file from MI5 about someone named Joseph Jacobs, the last man to be put to death in the Tower of London on August 15th, 1941. He was a German spy, an Abwehr agent. He parachuted into Cambridgeshire in 1941, but broke his ankle when landing and was soon arrested by the Home Guard. On his person was found a photo purportedly of his lover, a German cabaret singer and actress named Clara Bauerl. Jacobs said that she was being trained as a spy and that had he made contact, she might have been sent over to England after him. However, there was no evidence that Clara was parachuted into England, and several witnesses describe that Clara was around 6 feet tall, while Bella was only 5 feet tall. So that's not quite matching up, that she was a German spy parachuting into London to go after her lover.
And also doesn't explain how she ended up in the tree. Like, I don't think they are suggesting she parachuted right into the tree and just landed in there and died.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. It's just, but I tell you what, this story does sound very, like, this sounds like a separate interesting story of this Joseph Jacobs. I mean, this was in this classified document. It doesn't sound related to Bella at
it's
all.
It's giving me some Inglorious Bastards vibes. Like, I'm just thinking very much, like, the, you know, the little spy intrigue when they're at the movie theater or whatever. Oh, man.
Oh, my God. I love it. And they also found out in 2016 that Clara had died in Berlin in December of 1942.
Oh, there you
so,
go. Okay.
Yeah. So she's, you know, that's out. But that had been a theory for a while. And then another theory, in 1945, an anthropologist and archaeologist named Margaret Murray at the University College London proposed an even more radical theory, that of witchcraft, because she believed that the severing of one hand was consistent with a ritual called the Hand of Glory after the victim had been killed during an occult ritual. Her ideas excited the local press and led investigators to consider another ritualistic killing of a man in a nearby town that was very similar. I am not mad at this theory because of the severing of the hand and the cloth in the mouth. It does give a ritualistic vibe. Sure. Like, why would you sever her hand and bury it nearby? Like, that is very weird.
Yeah.
That is very weird.
I'm sorry, maybe I missed it as I was trying to wrap my head around this. Is the tree placement involved with this particular ritual? Is that explained at all?
That is a very good point. You know, I might actually pull up, let me pull up the article for Hand of Glory, because usually it's...
It sounds like something you get in a back alley, or...
That's the whole of glory.
The 7 minutes in heaven when, you know, a couple of teenagers have to go into the, you know, rumpus room. Was it a rumpus room, little closet?
Yeah.
Spin the bottle or something.
So a hand of glory is a dried and pickled hand of a hanged man, which is often specified as being the left hand, or if the person was hanged for murder, the hand that did the deed. So what's interesting about that is if someone did take her hand, it's not quite the same because they didn't pickle it or preserve it. But I think there is definitely something kind of to the whole severing of a hand thing. It almost makes you wonder, like, that's something that's also done when somebody steals something.
Right.
This goes back to if she was a sex worker and somebody got a hold of her that was real messed up.
Yeah.
Like a serial killer type person. You know, that's where you would find those ritualistic murder characteristics. But in 1953, another theory surfaced, namely that the victim was a Dutch woman named Clarabella Dronkers. She had been killed by a German spy ring consisting of a British officer, a Dutchman, and a music hall artist for, quote, knowing too much. But there aren't very many records that support this. But now we have two possible spy theories tied to the Germans, which the Germans, we expect them in 1941.
In the UK, no less. Yeah, this is also now the third movie script that has come out of this story. There's like three movie scripts out of this story already. And I'm going to guess there's maybe even at least one more before you wrap up. My goodness.
No, actually, I think that was the end of the theory list in general. But there was a really cool thing because, again, they don't have her actual skeleton. I almost said skeleton. They don't have her skeleton. They were able to take the pictures and do, you know, 3D, right, whatever, and reconstruct her face, which I think is just really incredible. And so when you think about it, though, this time period is very, it's turbulent, yeah, right? You have the war going on, you have, and again, the ritualistic killing stuff, and the fact that they lost track of all the evidence at the time. And I think it was almost just a consequence of the war, probably more than anything espionage related, but it's tempting to go that route just given everything that was going on at that period of time. And so I don't think we'll ever solve this one just because we don't have enough information.
Right.
But it's really, really interesting how she's kind of become this piece of folklore that people attach a lot of things to. She's a bit like the missing person version of Israel Keyes. And I mean that when we can't figure out who murdered a person, maybe Israel Keyes did it.
Yeah.
Or it's like there's all these women that went missing or died or were involved in some stuff, and it's like, oh, it could be her.
Right.
Maybe it's her.
Right.
You know? So she could be any number of people that were involved in some stuff. But ultimately, I feel like the missing sex worker, the locality where she was found, I could absolutely imagine a malicious person or John doing something awful to her and just sticking her in that tree until kids find her later on. Since we'll never really know, then the legend lives on.
Yeah, unless they're able to somehow miraculously recover her skeleton and perform some, you know, and can extract DNA and perform some, you know, analysis on, you know, maybe there's some bone or tissue or hair or something where they could, you know, potentially similarly to Somerton Man, is try to find some kind of, you know, genealogical connection.
Right.
And, oh yeah, my grandmother, my aunt, you know, my great whatever. Absent that, I think you're right. I don't think there's any way to solve it. And even if they have it, obviously there's no guarantee. But yeah, just crazy that an entire skeleton would vanish like that.
Oh, and the graffiti just adds to it, by the way. People making that.
That's the one where I'm like, is there anything to that? Or is it just someone heard the story, it gets passed around, and somebody, as a prank or a whatever, decides to, you know, do a little graffiti, and then the graffiti becomes associated. Much like you said, there's that person who was like, oh yeah, Van Gogh committed suicide, and that became the prevailing story. And you just have to wonder, is there something not too dissimilar going on here, and that the graffiti is just completely separate?
Yes,
But is now intermixed as, well, somebody knew something and didn't know what to say, so they went through these dramatic means to let whoever know, to send a signal that we know what happened.
Right. I agree.
I mean, I guess it's possible, but yeah, I don't know.
I left this out of my original notes because I think it's almost a little too sensationalistic. Some people had said that her hand had been buried 13 paces from the tree, which was common in witch assassinations or witch killings.
Oh, okay.
But my thing about that is 13 paces, it's not a very objective form of measurement, depending on the length of your stride. So I feel like that was just something somebody kind of like threw in there. I can't attribute that to anything. But again, the hand being buried nearby and the strip of cloth in the mouth suggests a ritualistic killing. I'm not buying the German spy MI5 stuff. I'm just not.
Right.
I mean, I'm gonna need a little more proof.
Yeah, that feels like a stretch. Like, absent some much stronger connection. It just feels like it's a, well, you know, here's something else we couldn't solve. Let's just twist these two together and see if they line up.
I had a lot of things to choose from when doing the UK of all places. I mean, a place just that's just known for all kinds of, you know, crazy mysteries and like haunted woods and things like that. And so this combines the two, where you have a murder mystery combined with creepy woods. So I think we covered the absolutely. Gamut, and we had the Germans coming in
and the sprinkled throughout our 10 countries,
which is just, it's just ties it up. It ties the whole episode together.
Come on, Germany. Quit getting into everybody else's mysteries. Everyone else have their own tales to tell. Goodness.
This was, again, so much fun. I want to say I think I almost enjoyed doing the countries more than the cities, but I think it might be because we're Americans. We need to get out. We want to get out of America a little bit and kind of go abroad.
I mean, we can do 10 cities abroad, 10 mysteries. Ooh, you know, we
can. Yes, indeed. I can find those.
In on some of those, you know,
I'm going to keep more digging localized. In on my metrics on the site and see
slice and dice,
if
man.
We have any new cities or any new countries that have been added to that have bumped another country out. And, you know, I'm just, I'll keep track of those and we'll be coming back and doing this again.
I'm so looking forward to 10 planets, 10 mysteries.
10 planets. Oh, so we're bringing Pluto back and then we're adding Planet X, which is, boom, you know.
There's your 10 there planets, go. Man. Come on.
We got this on lock, man.
We already have the planet that no longer is and the mysterious planet that might be. So I'm just saying, like, we can do 10 planets, 10 mysteries. Or 10 moons, 10 mysteries.
10 moons. There we go. You can do Saturn. And then Jupiter, because they each have like 10 or 15, 20 moons.
There's like I think there's like a thousand moons between those two. It's like, yeah, they have like a crazy number.
Freaking moon hoes. Just, you know, moon hoes.
They got their moon honeys, their moon groupies.
Oh, man. I will go ahead and bring this one to a close. And I, again, when I think about when I was putting this out, this show, this podcast, this idea that people all around the world would listen to it anywhere, just kind of blew my mind. And I am so grateful. And I hope I was able, or Chris and I were both able to kind of bring some interesting attention, maybe not always the best attention, but interesting attention to your country on this list. So if you have any questions at all, please give me a shout at Gmail, ddarknesstime@gmail.com. Or you can hit me up on Facebook, on the Facebook page for Ding Dong Darkness Time. You can also find me on the Twitter and on the Insta. And who knows where else, you know, we're putting all kinds of fun stuff together. So.
And if we missed a mystery or a country that you're like, how could you forget us? There's something amazing. Give us a shout out. Who knows? Maybe we'll be able to cobble together a listener curated episode to add more countries, more mysteries, more cities, more all the things.
I am looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to hearing from you and what you think about all this. And in the meantime, we will be back at you with another crazy tale another time.
Until then, be good, you little ding-dongs.
That's right. This episode was produced by yours truly, Allison Nixon, and wouldn't be possible without the amazing contributions of countless friends, family, and Patreon supporters. Big shouts also go out to Nathaniel Dixon for all the show art, as well as Spencer Morlock and Ken Dixon for the music. I'll be back with something new next week. In the meantime, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.